I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Valentin Abi, founder of the Caribbean Harvest Foundation, an organization that is helping to revitalize the commercial farming industry in Haiti. The Caribbean Harvest Foundation uses solar-powered hatcheries to produce tilapia fingerlings, which are then raised in the cages in villages around the nearby lake. The Caribbean Harvest Foundation is alleviating poverty by employing locals and creating a healthy, sustainable food supply throughout Haiti. Dr. Abi started the Caribbean Harvest Foundation in 2005 and is originally from the Ivory Coast. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor for me to be here with you.
How does the Caribbean Harvest Foundation work?
Good question. So basically, the way it works is that we have sponsoring partners, and with that money, we purchase the kits and then give the kits to the farmers for the program in Haiti. The sponsorship is $2,600 per family. And so we take the kids to the families and we teach them how to grow fish. The fingerlings are 2 months old when they come out of the hatchery.
Fingerlings being baby fish.
The baby fish, yeah, they're 2 months old. And then so we take them to the farmers, and the farmers will actually care for them for 4 months. And for every pound of fish that the farmer produces, he gets 40 cents. And that farmer is set for life.
And has tilapia always been a popular fish in Haiti? Or you have introduced tilapia as part of the Haitian diet?
Unfortunately, fish didn't play a big part of the Haitian diet. And that's one of the reasons why we started the program to start with. Just to give you some numbers, on the average, a Haitian will consume around 8 pounds of fish per year. The world average right now is around 34 pounds per person per year.
Now, you'd think an island would have fish as a prominent feature of the diet. Why wasn't or why isn't fish a big part of the Haitian diet? Why is it that fish are not thriving in the local waters and the rivers of Haiti so that fish would be more accessible to people?
Well, you have a couple of reasons for that. First of all, Port-au-Prince and surrounded towns, they count for 4.5 million people, okay? The entire country is 10.4 million. And then they don't have a good trash collection system. So everything, all the trash goes out to the sea.
So the bay is extremely polluted because they don't have a good trash system.
Yeah, trash system. Now, if you go into the inland reservoirs, the water is not polluted at all. It's a good, clean water. But the government never had a program to stock the lakes. And so the people living around these lakes have completely overfished them. You have some lakes. Before we started working around Lake Azuay, the lake was completely empty. You know, you have a lot of fish in the south, but 60% of this fish is spoiled before they reach the market in Port-au-Prince.
It's spoiled because it takes so long over these roads that are in bad condition to get to Port-au-Prince,
yeah,
to the market.
And there is no cold chain, no ice, nothing.
I see. So the fish are not refrigerated or put on ice to preserve them on the journey.
Yeah.
You started the organization in 2005 in Haiti, around Lake Azuay.
Yes.
Which is called the Blue Lake, which is the largest lake in Haiti. How did you convince people, originally villagers, to come on board the project?
No, it was not easy at all. It was not easy at all. First of all, they didn't understand the program that I wanted to implement. And then culturally, Haitians are not trusting type of people. And so it took us a while. It took us about 2 years for them to really see and understand what we wanted to do.
Did they see you as outsiders? I mean, here you are from the Ivory Coast.
you know, you're going to laugh about it, but when I came in the beginning, they'll call me blanc, which is the white. Okay, but that's how they call all the foreigners. But after a while, you know, you integrate the communities, and so now I'm part of that those communities where we work.
What do you think was the catalyst for the villagers to come on board and to adopt the program?
Well, some people will say the type of personality that I have. One thing that I did was try to be part of the community. It's not like a foreigner that will, you know, go there with a bag of rice, give it to them, and go. No, no, you go out there, you eat with them, you play with the kids, and then you try to implement things within the community that they can see and relate with.
So, for example?
Well, for example, one of the communities that we started working is a small village called Mandambelize. They didn't have a school. The kids have to walk 3 miles to get to the nearest school. A kid, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, shouldn't walk 3 miles to go to school. So I went out to raise the money and build a school.
Finally, when you did have the villagers coming on board to help you harvest the tilapia and get the program going, how did you get the funding initially?
I started with my own money. And then, you know, after that, we get our first funding from the French government.
What was harder than you thought? I mean, convincing the locals to buy into the project certainly wasn't easy. What else was more challenging than you thought it would be?
Well, what was really challenging is that, you know, the goals that I set myself kept changing. Initially, when I started the program, the idea was to show that you could, you know, take a group of people, teach them to raise fish, and be successful. And then when we went to these villages and we started teaching them to raise fish, then we started to see all the different problems that they were having, like education. The areas where we were working didn't have drinking water. They didn't have health care programs. And so there was a time where, you know, I actually thought that for a program to be successful, then you have to address all these other issues.
Which you've incorporated into your
yes.
program.
But in the beginning, I was not prepared for that. That was not my initial intent.
You are from the Ivory Coast. Mm-hmm. You're one of 8 children. Your mom sold fish and your dad was a mechanic. Who introduced you to aquaculture? In your early interest was in agronomy or in the raising of cattle. You specialize in the artificial insemination of cattle.
You know, that's a good story. My dad really wanted me to become a medical doctor. That was his dream. So fortunately, I was a very good student. I graduated in high school, the top of my class. So I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew it was not medical school. And while we were talking to a few friends, they said, well, the agronomy department, they have this program where all the top students get scholarship to go to France. So I said, oh, yeah? So I said, okay, well, I wanted to get out of the Ivory Coast so bad that I just walked to the agronomy department and registered.
Just to get yourself out of the Ivory Coast.
Just out of the Ivory Coast.
You never made it to France, though, because instead the scholarship organization called you and offered you a Fulbright scholarship
mm-hmm.
to go and study in the United States.
Yes.
So you didn't even reach out to apply for a Fulbright. You just,
no,
it was handed to you.
It was handed to me.
And the Fulbright requirement was that you study aquaculture.
Yes.
And that's how you got involved in the study of fish and water life.
That's correct.
You went to the University of Auburn in Alabama, and there's a story that you met Dr. Phelps, one of your instructors, and you saw him for the first time waist deep in a pond, and you said at that moment you knew that you had found your calling.
Yes. Coming from the Ivory Coast, and I was all dressed up, you know, nice white pant and shirt. I put on my nicest shoes. So I get to the station, and I've heard about Dr. Phelps, and here this guy, world-renowned professor in a fish pond, mud all over him with this big catfish teaching a class. I said, hey, I found hope. I mean, I'll die with that image. That's something that will never leave my mind.
After your Fulbright and after your time at Auburn, you made it to Haiti in 1997, really because of a man named Bill Schneider, who was part of the Rotary Club, and he went down to help build a health clinic and saw the poverty and wanted to know, well, how do we help alleviate this? And somebody suggested providing the population with more fish.
Yes. And so how he contacted Auburn, he said, well, I want to really teach the people of Haiti how to raise fish. And so how can you, you know, help him? So the university said, well, we'll send someone over there to, you know, investigate and work with you. And they picked me to go because of my French background. You know, I speak French. And so that's how I got to Haiti.
Why tilapia? Why was it tilapia that you introduced to the population?
First, the easiest answer is that they're easy to grow.
Now, you have two types of tilapia that you farm, Israeli tilapia and Egyptian tilapia. Can you tell me a little bit about Egyptian tilapia?
The Egyptian variety is a strictly freshwater fish. You know, doesn't tolerate salt and grows really fast. It has the fastest growth rate of all the tilapia. The Israeli variety doesn't have a good growth rate, but it's very salt tolerant. And some of the lakes where we're working in Haiti are brackish, and so they're a little bit salty. And so we couldn't raise the Israeli alone because of the growth rate. And so what we do is that we bred them with the Egyptian to have both the growth rate and also the salt tolerance.
So just given the geopolitical poetry of merging Egyptian and Israeli fish, is that why they're called those two names? Why are they called Israeli and Egyptian?
No. That's because of where they're originally from.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Valentin Abe, founder of the Caribbean Harvest Foundation, an organization focused on creating sustainable aquaculture in Haiti, one of the most impoverished countries in the world. The Caribbean Harvest Foundation's hatcheries produce tilapia, which are then transferred to cages in nearby lakes and cared for by local villagers whose income has increased as much as 800%. Dr. Abe was chosen as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world in 2010. I want to talk about this recognition in Time Magazine in 2010. How did you find out that you were on this list?
Well, they actually called me. And, you know, I received a phone call, and they said, you've been chosen by Time Magazine as 100 most influential people in the world. And first of all, I thought it maybe was a joke or something like that. But, you know, and I was in the field when they called me. And so when I went home, I checked it, you know, Time Magazine. And I knew what it was. And
you mean you checked on your computer to see if there really was such a list?
Yeah, and because something really bizarre, I never heard of it. Yeah, and apparently it was something really big, you know. So the lady called me back again. She said, do you accept the nomination? And I said, well, of course I accept the nomination. That's how it happened.
And it was President Bill Clinton who nominated you to be on the Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential Person to be on this list. Mm-hmm. How did you meet him?
Actually, in 2008, it was a UN envoy for Haiti.
There was a UN envoy
to Haiti. When he went to Haiti, some of his assistants wanted to know the lay of the land. So one of his assistant called me, and he told me that I've heard about the program and I wanted to visit it.
What came out of that visit other than the Time Magazine recognition?
Well, he became personally involved in the program. I mean, personally, it was kind of the spokesperson of the program. So everywhere he goes, he will mention the program, he will talk about the program. So we started attracting attention, and with that also came funding.
How was that for you personally? I mean, here Bill Clinton is your chum, your PR person.
Well, it was pretty overwhelming. it was pretty big. Especially, not only he was a spokesperson, but anytime he will go places, he will invite me to come with him.
Where did you go with him, for example?
I was in Aspen, Colorado with him, and one Miami together. Anytime he will go to Haiti, sometimes he will invite me to dinner.
You have three girls, mm-hmm. you're married, and your family lives in the Dominican Republic,
yes.
across the border.
Mm-hmm.
How long is the drive from...
7 hours.
7 hours from home to work. Why the commute?
Well, the family was living with me in Haiti in the beginning. And then in 2004, we have some a political crisis in Haiti. Haiti was very dangerous. And so the closest place where I could send them was in the Dominican Republic at that time.
So what is your commute like?
Basically, what I do is that I spend 3 weeks in Haiti and 1 week with my family in the Dominican Republic. When I'm really tired, I'll take the bus. I don't like driving all by myself for 7 hours.
Mm.
So I just take the bus.
Do you listen to music?
Yes, I do.
What do you listen to?
I'm a big jazz fan. Mostly I will have have a CD player if I'm driving. I love classic jazz. You know, Miles Davis is one of my favorite. I will also listen to some John Coltrane, depending on the mood. Grover Washington Jr. is a good one. The guitar players, we have Lee Ritenour, Earl Klug.
Okay, you.
I can go on and go on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Definitely a pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Valentin Abi. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.